Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to introduce to you tonight Michael Blakemore, one of our most distinguished theatre directors. Many of you, I think, will have seen productions of Michael's at various times. He's, of course, noted, among other things, for his work at the National Theatre as an associate director. He's, of course, well known for his work with Michael Frayn, Peter Nichols, for his productions of Chekhov. And, of course, in 2000, Michael won a 2 Tony Awards for productions on Broadway, both for Best Director for his production of Copenhagen and Best Director for his production of a musical, Kiss Me, Kate. Recently, he's published an autobiography, Arguments with England, and I hope later to ask him what his arguments are exactly.
Many.
And so that I'm looking forward to hearing about that. Also, of course, he's written what many consider to be one of the best novels ever written about theatre, Next Season, which very interestingly charts the life of a young actor in England in the 1950s. What we're going to do tonight are three things. Michael's going to read to you from the book, first of all. Then I'll talk to him and ask him a few questions of my own and ask him about his career. And then finally, we'll, for the last 20 minutes or so, open up for questions from the audience. So without further ado, can we welcome Michael Blakemore, who'll then read to us from his...
I wasn't quite sure what you would be interested in, and I've selected what was a very important job to me when I was in my mid-20s. I went on the European tour of Titus Andronicus with Laurence Olivier and Vivian Leigh. So that's the bit that I thought I would read to you. It involves a couple of quotes from Titus, and I'm not Olivier, but I'll read the text as best I can. In the theatre, one piece of luck tends to engender another, and for the first time in my career, I found myself on something of a roll. Because of its young star, Albert Finney, Henry V had attracted national attention, and one of our visitors had been the hugely prestigious Shakespeare Memorial Theatre. This was a performance in Birmingham. As a result, I was now contemplating the most exciting offer of my career, the European tour of Peter Brook's production of Titus Andronicus, starring Laurence Olivier and Vivian Leigh. This had been the hit of the previous season at Stratford-upon-Avon, and the only actor, apart from Spear Carriers, not available from the original company, was James Grout. It was his part, the Roman captain, that I was being offered. Not a large role, but one with a good speech that paved the way for Titus' first entrance and a clear line throughout the production. I would be named in the programme and no doubling required. I kept a journal during the rehearsals, which records a typically neurotic start to the engagement. On the first morning, I was so preoccupied by what would be appropriate attire that I left the flat later than I intended and, seeing not a bus in sight, panicked and caught a taxi. I asked the driver to let me out at Cambridge Circus, thinking perhaps that it would be less ostentatious if I walked to the Scala Theatre rather than to be seen arriving at the stage door by cab. Once there, I realised I'd made an awful mistake and that rehearsals were being held not at the Scala but at the Stole. With only 5 minutes to spare, I ran back along Tottenham Court Road looking for yet another taxi and managed to hail one exactly where the previous cab had let me out. I reached the Stole with a minute to spare, sweat running down the inside legs of my trousers and 7 shillings out of pocket. On stage, among the gathered company, there was time to get my breath. A few yards away were the great stars, Laurence Olivier and Vivian Leigh. I watched them reuniting with other principals, like important arrivals on a railway platform, who exchanged kisses and hugs among the porters and the passers-by. They didn't yet know me, but I knew them, their faces, their voices, the way they moved, almost as well as my own family. On screens all over Sydney, I'd seen their eyes, as big as headlamps, mist with feeling. I'd seen them laugh, kiss, and lament in monochrome and colour. And here they were, a few yards away, tinted miniatures of their other selves, stars whose two-dimensional image had been among the first to spread across the world like a new virus. In that brief period of the talkies, before the theatre had lost its prestige with the general public, before television had made screened entertainment commonplace, this acting elite held sway in both mediums, playing to audiences whom a surfeit of drama had yet to break down into that more sluggish and sceptical component, the viewer. They were famous, lacquered in glamour, and magically skilled. And unique among this unique generation was Laurence Olivier, who had somehow juggled huge celebrity with artistic achievements of the highest order. Was it any wonder that I found this day significant, a completion to a journey of 12,000 miles and 7 years? Here I was on the 22nd of April, 1957, sharing the stage with the greatest actor of his generation. Such intimations of destiny are important to young actors whose lives are mainly contingent, depending on chance and the whims of other people. But as we started on the day's work, reality was quick to intrude, and the subterranean struggle between generations to begin. Here is my first day's comment. Seeing Sir Laurence across the stage from me with his script in his hand and his glasses perched on the end of his nose was to realize that he was just another actor like me, a man who had to shave in the morning and probably feel sleepy after lunch. I look at him now like a puzzle to be solved, a nut to be cracked, and watching him just today, moving about the stage with his relaxed comedian's rhythm, I think I'm already getting at his secret. Most of the newcomers of the cast were young males in the lower half of the company, and as the week progressed and our excitement at landing the job diminished, rehearsals became an agony of watching and hoping to be watched. I studied these contemporaries as they assumed expressions or struck attitudes which would testify to their untapped abundance of talent and keenness, saw the foolishness of it, but at the same time couldn't help doing the same thing myself. I watched Olivier constantly while appearing not to do so, and one of the things I noticed was that he was often watching us. His eyes kept swinging over the newcomers, assessing us perhaps, or just practicing which name went with which face. I also noticed that Olivier smoked Olivier cigarettes, a brand, like others named after famous performers, de Maurier and de Reski, now no longer on the market, that in the first week he never wore the same outfit twice, and that he and Vivian Leigh frequently gave rather rehearsed displays of affection, as if the rest of the company, like a theatre audience, weren't really there. Apart from the brittle artificiality of these moments, he seemed in exceptionally down-to-earth good spirits, and no wonder. He had just finished the run of The Entertainer at the Royal Court and was now embarking on a revival of his most striking success in a classical role since the days of Richard III and Oedipus Rex. It was, however, Peter Brook who most dominated my first week. Titus Andronicus was quite as much his triumph as Olivier's. He had not only directed it, but composed the music and overseen the groundbreaking design, an austere monochrome conjurer's box which would unexpectedly open up to reveal a splash of luminous colour. It did not reject conventional theatricality with quite the flourish of his later Midsummer Night's Dream, but it was already pointing in that direction. It was like nothing we'd seen before. Since I was the only newcomer with lines and with an important speech that came early in the play, I was quickly thrown into the thick of rehearsals. But Brooke responded to my situation with tact and quickly earned my trust. He had that concentration in which empathy and detachment are somehow combined that I was beginning to recognize as the mark of a good director. It was a pleasure to watch him as he watched us, his small bright eyes flicking here and there, taking everything in, his expression one of involved amusement, a signal to us all that though we were working, we were also at play. He could occasionally be sharply impatient, and I record one such occasion. At this afternoon's rehearsals, Peter Brook really put his actors through the mill. Not me, fortunately, though I felt strongly for those concerned. It reinforced my conviction that it helps if a director has had some experience of acting. All of Brook's points were perceptive, but the remedies were needlessly painful. He hammered away at externals, inflections and movements, until the poor actors were quite undermined and confused. Just a word or two at a slightly deeper level would probably have done the trick in half the time. If an actor has the right concept of a scene, then the rest follows. If he has the wrong one, then no amount of detailed direction can help him. End of quote. This, of course, is the actor speaking. As a director, I wish things were as simple. Occasionally, Peter had a go at me, but I never found it upsetting because it always seemed to be about the work, upon which we were both engaged, not about me personally. Peter Brook, I wrote, has the knack of treating everyone exactly the same from the stars down. Yesterday he buzzed about the auditorium, stinging indiscriminately. By and large, however, I was having the time of my professional life. One day's entry begins, "I am beginning to mistrust myself. I am too happy in this job. I keep thinking that the next day's rehearsal will bring me down to earth again." This never happened. Just being on stage with Olivier and hearing him pitch that extraordinary voice to the back of the auditorium with the precision of an arrow was excitement enough. He was 49, at the zenith of his powers, and luxuriating in the relaxed ride occasionally afforded by the theatre when a great success is given a second lease of life. Every young actor in the company knew his opening speech by heart, and impressions of his unique delivery resonated along corridors and in dressing rooms. On came the war-weary old soldier to a solemn march, accompanied by the coffins of his sons killed in battle, and raised one hand in a Roman salute. "Hail, Rome, victorious in thy mourning weeds. Lo, as the bark that has discharged her fraught returns with precious ladings to the bay from which at first she weighed her anchorage, cometh Andronicus, bound with laurel boughs, to resalute his country with his tears, tears of true joy for his return to Rome." Most of this he spoke in one sustained breath, making a sound as assured in its reserved power as a plane as it starts to move down the runway. And if ever a performance took wing, it was his Titus. The street scene, about a third into the play, remains the most extraordinary 15 minutes I have ever experienced in the theatre. I watched from the side of the stage every time it was rehearsed, at every performance on tour and in London, and never ceased to be amazed by it. In a way, it was the justification for doing the play in the first place, and nothing that followed, either in the writing or the acting, could match it. Olivier cobbled the rest of his part together with a series of vocal and physical surprises that owed as much to theatrical guile and experience as they did to imagination. The street scene was on another plane. On the page, it is an improbable string of horrors, redeemed to some extent by language. It begins with Titus pleading for the lives of his two sons as their judges escort them offstage to arbitrary execution. A third and only remaining son tries to forestall the sentence, only to suffer banishment. Next, Titus's brother Marcus leads on his daughter Lavinia, who has been first raped, then had her tongue cut out and her hands lopped off to prevent her putting a name to her assailants. Titus's misfortunes are not over. Aaron the Moor appears and offers him a grim bargain. If he will allow his own hand to be cut off, it will be accepted in exchange for the lives of his condemned sons. Titus agrees, and his betrayal becomes absolute. A messenger enters, returning his hand to him with the severed heads of his two sons. It is now given to his brother to lament. Titus says nothing. Marcus, why art thou still? Why dost thou laugh? It fits not with this hour. Titus, why, I have not another tear to shed. The production handled the physical horrors with a discretion that, by distancing them, purged them of melodrama and gave them an ominous credibility. Lavinia's mutilations were suggested not by stage blood, but by red ribbons spilling from her wrists and mouth. When Titus lost his hand to Aaron, it was with his back to the audience, conveyed by a spasm of the shoulders and the horrific sound of the chop. And the two heads and the severed hand were returned to him in wicker cages, so that Titus at first could only guess at the contents within. In England, the production had been praised as a brilliant interpretation of a ghoulish and unlikely play. But when we performed it in Poland and Yugoslavia, countries in which the memory of the Nazi occupation was very much alive, its horrors were accepted as the literal truth. Recently, I read of an incident in South Africa in which some youths occupied a house randomly chosen in a prosperous suburb and held the wife captive. As each of her three children returned from school, they hanged them one by one in front of her. When the husband returned from work, he too was hanged. Only then did they kill the woman. It was Olivier's comprehension, tapping into some recess of melancholic dread inside himself, of what it must be like to experience the very worst that life has to offer, that gave the scene its mesmeric power. That, and the paradoxical actor's relish of knowing that he was onto something that could freeze an audience in its seats. He charted Titus's agony stage by stage. With his beloved daughter, he was like an animal in a trap that in its misery turns on itself. What fool hath added water to the sea or brought a faggot to bright burning Troy? My grief was at its height before thou camest, and now, like Nilus, it disdaineth bounds. Give me my sword, I'll chop off my hands too. The text is shot through with imagery of the sea. For now I stand as one upon a rock, environed with a wilderness of sea, who marks the waxing tide grow wave by wave, expecting ever when some envious surge will in its brinish bowels swallow him. The metaphor reaches its height when, having sacrificed his own hand, he likens his daughter to the reigning sky, himself to the ocean. His brother Marcus has counseled him, but yet let reason govern thy laments. And Titus replies, if there were reason for these miseries, then into limits could I bind my woes. When heaven doth weep, doth not the earth o'erflow? If the winds rage, doth not the sea wax mad, threatening the welkin with his big swollen face? And wilt thou have a reason for this coil? I am the sea. And here Olivia took a huge strangled breath, a guttural intake which suddenly exploded on the next sentence. Hark how her sighs do blow. She is the weeping welkin, I the earth. Then must my sea be moved with her sighs. Then must my earth with her continual tears become a deluge, overflowed and drowned. The text tumbling out of him like lava from a volcano, he suddenly rose and propelled himself to one side of the stage, as if his pain was something physical from which he had to shake himself free. The speech over, he stood quite still, the only sound his exhausted breathing, the only movement on stage the rise and fall of his chest. Into this stillness comes the messenger with the heads of his two sons. It was then that Marcus asks his question, why dost thou laugh? And Titus replies, why, I have not another tear to shed. The French star Pierre Frenet once described an actor as a sculptor in snow, and Olivia was fond of quoting him. Titus was, above all, a shaped performance. In the street scene, he left outlines of himself trailing in one's minds as graphic as an illustration by William Blake. And he organized the verse into great blocks and ascending steps of language, welded together by the remorseless pulse of the iambic pentameter. It was acting as soaring as architecture, the way the structure in one of Brahms' great orchestral finales can sometimes seem almost palpable. What rescued it from contrivance were those moments of behavioral truth, insights into Titus's plight, that were not only psychological, but physiological. At one performance, I was amazed when, at the end of the speech I've described, his breath came in stops and starts, with moments in between in which he seemed to have stopped breathing altogether. Doctors are taught this is symptomatic of major shock. He had intuited it, perhaps hardly aware of what he was doing or how powerful it made the moment, because it was the only time it happened. Few of Olivier's great stage moments survive translation to the screen. On film, he tries to repeat by an effort of will that which, in the theatre, the presence of a willing audience elicited from him. He could smell their attention, their stillness, and eventually their submission as he stalked them like prey. Got him, he is said to have whispered to his fellow actors on the first night of Oedipus Rex as he turned away after his famous and protracted howl of recognition and despair. At the height of one of these great moments, the audience riveted, the auditorium ringing with his voice. There was something in the performance almost akin to relaxation, as if what we were seeing was only part of the power available to him. On film, you sense exertion, and the results to those who loved his work on stage are often unsettling, because what you see is the very opposite of what you experienced in the theatre, the limitations of this sort of acting. There is one precious strip of film taken during a live charity performance of The Entertainer that captures the great performer at his best. Like Fred Astaire dancing, he might just as well be airborne. Later in life, he insisted he no longer enjoyed acting, but I don't think this was quite true. When the juices were flowing, he probably enjoyed it too much, but increasingly a triumphant night left him with misgivings about being able to repeat it, and when this was compounded with fear about remembering his lines, his pleasure in acting was all but eroded, at least until he was actually on stage. Besides, his performances was so audacious, characterized by moments in which there was always the possibility of humiliating misjudgments or even physical danger, that like many great artists, he became intimidated by the very standards he himself had set. He was an actor of the greatest courage, the more so because he had the intelligence to know exactly the risks he was running. This could leave him moody and beleaguered when he was preparing a part, but on Titus we saw none of this until the dress rehearsal in Paris.
Thank you. In your book, you talk about Olivier as a major influence on your actually becoming an actor in the first place. I wonder if you could tell us a bit about why you became an actor, what instigated, what developed your interest in the theatre in the first place.
Well, by accident, really. Like a lot of people in my generation, when I was a kid, I wanted to be a film director. We all wanted to be film directors. I wasn't really interested in the theatre, and then I went to see Henry V and the film, Olivier's film, and was absolutely bowled over by it. I got a letter from an actor I was at RADA with, my age, John Nettleton, and he was in England when I was in Australia, and he went to see Henry V at the Odeon in the town in which he lived, and he was at the theatre for the rest of the week. He couldn't stay away. He must have seen it 10 times. And in fact, my generation, if you see the film now, there have been many other films, the Branner Henry V, which is also very good, but the power of that film at the time was just amazing. And we were all imprinted. We were like the grey-legged goose. We were all young, and along came this charismatic actor and turned us all into actors. We went around. I used to play his record endlessly, a disco volume in the flat and that I lived in. And I suddenly thought, that's what I want to do. I want to be an actor. So then I got a job with Robert Morley doing publicity, and that was moderately successful. And at the end of my job with him, he was touring Australia, he said to me, well, my boy, what do you want to do with your life? And I said, well, I think I want to be a director. And he said, well, you'll have to develop a great deal more personality than you have at the moment if you want to be a director. I suggest you be an actor. Actors can get away with anything. So he wrote to Sir Kenneth Barnes at RADA, and I came to England and got in and became an actor.
In the book, you actually talk about life at RADA, and then you talk about your early days as an actor in provincial rep and so forth. Can you tell us a bit about your experiences at RADA and those early days in provincial rep in England in the 50s?
Well, I was a pretty awful actor at RADA. I was very stiff and wooden. And I remember there was a teacher who I designate in the book as Miss X, because I don't want to name these people. I was trying to play Hastings in She Stoops to Conquer. And she used to get infuriated with me because I was so stiff. And she said, suddenly I was trying to play this part, and she suddenly yelled from the darkness, Michael, you're standing there on both legs. And I looked out into the auditorium and she said, go to the West End, go into any theatre. Good actors don't stand on both legs. They stand first on their right, then on their left. Surely you must see that. And of course, this embarrassed me even further, and I was reduced to I was completely wooden, ossified. But then there was an actor at RADA who was an American, and he was from the group theatre. He was a method actor called Jack Salamanca. Finally gave up acting and became a novelist. And he was very good, and I watched him, and I sort of studied him, and I learned more from this student than I did from any other teacher. And he really taught me to act, and by the end of my 2 years there, I could do it well enough to get a job. Not a very good job, but it was a job. I vanished into the depths of repertory in the North Country, and in those days it was very, very tough, because it was weekly rep, and you had to do a new play every week. That meant you were rehearsing the act of one play during the day, you were playing at night, and then you're going home after you'd played and staying up till 2 or 3 in the morning, learning another act of the new play you would be doing for rehearsal the following morning. So you did it over and over and over again, all these plays over and over again. And I didn't like it. I didn't think I learned much from it, except I was initiated very rapidly into almost every horror that you can imagine being an actor on stage. So that I developed so much scar tissue that it was impossible thereafter ever to be embarrassed when things went wrong. But everything went wrong. I mean, one forgot one's lines, people didn't turn up, bits of the set fell down. I mean, once you've been through a season of Weekly Rep, you were inoculated for life against the horrors of being an actor. And then I slowly graduated to better companies, and it's amazing the difference that 2 weeks rehearsal makes as opposed to 1 week's rehearsal. And it's doubly amazing the difference that 3 weeks rehearsal makes. And finally I got to companies like the Birmingham Rep, which had 4 weeks to rehearse. And then I really began to enjoy my work, and it was from the Birmingham Rep that I got this job in Titus.
And after Titus, you joined the Royal Shakespeare Company.
Yes, I
and,
did.
And you worked, I think, again with Olivier in
yes.
Coriolanus, and you worked in the Lawton Midsummer Night's Dream. And in particular, you talk very highly about Tyrone Guthrie and the production of All's Well That Ends Well, which you also appeared in. Can you tell us a bit about Guthrie and your admiration, the reasons for your admiration for him as a director?
It's very hard to do this because I've written it all in the book, and I know, and I feel I'm sort of butchering the book with my stumbles if I try to describe it to you. But he was a wonderful man to the extent that he created an almost ideal atmosphere in which actors could work. He had great curiosity about everybody under his care. He was something of a martinet. He wasn't a soft man, and if you didn't work very hard indeed, you soon knew it. But he created a climate in which personality grew. And he was very interested in young people and in unimportant people in the company. It was said of Guthrie that he treated the stars like walk-ons and the walk-ons like stars. He was very rude to the principal actors, but he was sensational if you were young and had a small part. And in the course of rehearsal, you'd see personality blooming in the room as actors who other people had always considered dull or uninteresting suddenly started doing interesting things. He was his grandfather, I think, had been a bishop, and there's a statue of him in Edinburgh, the bishop, that is. And Guthrie certainly had a sort of evangelical zeal about him. He was irritated with commercial theatre. He didn't like complacency. He hated actors when they got successful and got spoilt. He was very rude about Hollywood. But he was always zooming off to other parts of the world to start theatres. I mean, he's the only director, a leading director of the day, who would ever have done what he did in the case of Stratford on Ontario. A couple of the local worthies rang him one day and said, "We live in Canada and we have a town called Stratford and we think it ought to have a theatre too." I mean, any other director would have said, "Well, that's nice, good luck," and hung up. But Guthrie said, "How interesting," and he jumped on a plane, went to Canada, and in the middle of the Canadian prairies, built this amazing theatre. The first year, he got Alec Guinness over to help him, who was a chum, and they played the first year in a tent, and then he was instrumental in raising money to build, I think, the first truly Shakespearean thrust stage that had ever been built in a commercial theatre, and with huge workshops and an administrative wing. And that theatre went on to nourish North American theatre to a very great extent. He did the same thing in Minneapolis. He used to go to Israel, he went to Australia, he went all over the place as a kind of an evangelist for theatre, I suppose.
And after the RSC, you then talk about the work you did with the Open Air Theatre at Regent's Park. And then I think you returned to Australia in a touring production. I got the sense in the book you almost experienced a sort of epiphany back in Australia and came back, if not a changed person, having come to terms with some of your issues with England and with Australia. And I suppose this is the point where I want to ask you a little bit about what your arguments with England are. Are they based on the Australia-England sort of differences or on concerns about British theatre? What are those arguments?
Well, the book, the bit that I read you is very much about the theatre. Theatrical book, because I presume that's what would interest you. But equally, I think it's not about theatre at all. It's about expatriation and what it means to be born in one country and come to another to make your life. And in the Australia of my growing up, England was an all-pervasive presence. I mean, our school, the school I went to was modelled on, a monstrous school, I might add, was modelled on an English public school. Lawyers wore wigs, and their final appeal was to the House of Lords. There was the British Medical, the BMA, there was a building called the BMA building where my father worked. We had this presence of England there in every aspect of our lives. And it was an idealized England. It wasn't the England that I subsequently came to know when I came over here. It was very sentimental, and a lot of people, I didn't, but a lot of people used to call England home. And if you were lucky, you made a boat trip once or twice in your life, and you got to the mother country and watched the changing of the guards and went to a couple of theatres and then went home. And so I came really to lay that ghost, to try and find out if it was true, and it wasn't. And also because England was where the best theatre in the world at that time was being performed, to both study my craft and see if I needed to become an Englishman, if I had to discard my Australianness in order to work, earn a living. And that's the argument. The argument is I suppose, slightly chippy Australian, looking at you lot.
You go back to Australia, and in a sense you come to terms with some of the sort of Australian past as well. You talk about your family and about Australia after that long time in Britain. And then you come back and you get a job in the Glasgow Citizens Theatre and get the opportunity to direct. And I think it's with A Day in the Death of Joe Aig, Peter Nichols' play, that your directing career really begins to take off. And in a sense, the rest is history. And that's where you actually end the book. Can you tell us a bit about how you moved across to directing, how it was that you became a director, and how that sort of became the sort of career you followed after having been an actor for quite a long period of time?
Yes. Well, I wasn't reconciled at all with Australia when I went back. Having been in England for 15 years, I sort of kept it in my mind like a sort of fallback position. And whereas in Australia I'd been subjected to an idealised England, in England I kept my spirits afloat by somewhat idealising Australia. And then I went back to Australia and I suddenly realised why I'd felt it necessary to leave. And the Australia that I went back to was Menzies Australia, and it was an awful place. And it concluded my arguments with England, because I realised that this, as an expatriate, was the way I wanted to live. So when I came back to England, my luck sort of changed quite extraordinarily, as if in making that decision, I'd cleared up the direction in my life, that my life would then be lived. How I became a director, I'd more or less given up hope of becoming a director, because every play requires, shall we say, a dozen, three or four, ten actors, but it only requires one director. And the directing game really seemed to me to be rather sewn up by the Oxbridge Mafia. And I didn't know how I could possibly get in. I wanted to do it. I'd made a couple of tries, but without success. But then I worked with a very good director in Regent's Park called David William, who did two very good productions, one of A Midsummer Night's Dream and the other of Love's Labour's Lost. And I was playing, in his season, mainly comic parts, which involved inventing comic business and so forth. And David, I got on very well with him and enjoyed him as a director. And he thought I should direct. And he went to the Glasgow Citizens Theatre. And when I was in Australia, he wrote me a letter saying, come and join me in the company. I've got a couple of good parts for you to play, and I've got three shows I'd like you to direct. And I didn't think I would be able to do it, because I had to take the show I was doing in Australia on to Melbourne. But he insisted. He wrote me a second letter saying, well, if you can't do it now, will you do it later? And I didn't really want to leave London, but I said, well, if he's got that much faith in me, of course I'll do it. So I went to Glasgow, and I did these three plays, one of which was a play called Little Malcolm and His Struggle Against the Eunuchs. and it was a big success, and to my astonishment, the board offered me and another actor director, Michael Meacham, the running of the theatre the year after, and then a close friend of mine who'd written this play, A Day in the Death of Joe Egg, which nobody would touch, been turned down by everybody, the Royal Court and every West End management you could think of, finally and rather reluctantly sent it to me. And I managed to get it through the board, because the board had the power in those days to censor what the program was. And it went on, went to London, went to New York. In that production, I wanted a piece of furniture on stage in which the disabled daughter could be placed so that she wouldn't distract attention when the play was moving elsewhere. And in the flat in which I lived, there was a chaise longue, a little bit Victorian chaise longue, that was ideal because it could be set with its back to the audience and the child could lie in it with her feet showing, but not her head. And so I reached a deal with the landlady. I think she charged £3 a week. And it went onto the stage at the Citizens Theatre. And then we took it to London, and the chaise longue moved with us to London. I think she got about £10 a week. And then the whole show moved to Broadway, and the chaise longue went across the water and went onto the Broadway stage, and I think she got about £200 a week. So she was doing very well.
There's so many further things I'd like to ask you about after Joe Egg that I might restrict myself just to a couple more questions and then open up to the audience. One more recent area of your work has been very much with the plays of Michael Frayn, and I wondered, given the high success of Copenhagen and of Democracy most recently, I wondered if you could tell us something both about your work with Michael Frayn and about this extraordinary ability you have to actually take quite a complex theme, a complex play even, and render it very clear to your audiences, and often get from your actors really extraordinarily strong performances as well. Can you tell us a bit about the work with Michael Frayn, the recent work?
I'm very, very lucky to have this working association with Michael Frayn. I mean, what directors need is close relationship with the playwright, because it all begins with those words on the page. And in my career, I've been extremely fortunate. I've done a lot of, about four of Peter Nichols' early works, I think his four best plays. I've done new plays by Arthur Miller and Don DeLillo and other people. But I've had a particular relationship with Michael Frayn. I think we've done, we were talking about it the other day, we couldn't remember how many we've done. He said seven, I said eight, or it was the other way around. Not all of them by any means have been successful. We've had a couple of real flops. But it's been a, most relations between director and author last about three productions. Then there are squabbles and fights and they agree to part. Fortunately, temperamentally, Michael and I fit in very well together. And the only thing we ever fought over was a translation he did of a Chekhov play, in which he made what would seem to me to be an absolutely unconscionable change of Chekhov's intentions, which I won't go into now. That's the only time we've ever disagreed. I gave in because I thought it was maybe better for the future. But he made a strange remark to me one day. We were in an interview with some journalists. And he said, the reason I think Michael and I get on well together is we're both slow thinkers. Now, I was prepared to admit that I was a slow thinker, but I didn't really think that Michael Frayn was a slow thinker. But he didn't mean, I'm glad to say, a stupid thinker or an unintelligent thinker. He simply meant a slow thinker, and that is the case. Michael is extraordinarily meticulous. His plays, like Noises Off, go like an express train, but he puts them together like a watchmaker, and he's extraordinarily precise, and he examines every single moment and line in his plays. Consequently, when I see a draft, the first draft, they're beautifully worked and deeply considered. There's none of that stuff about we'll get it right in rehearsals or what do you think of this draft? Will I do another one? I then make a few suggestions, sometimes in the case of Noises Off, some quite radical ones, because it was a farce and it's very easy to interfere and multiply the complexities of farce. In something like Copenhagen, very, very few suggestions except for possible clarity. But I think that the way he writes is the way I direct, not in the rehearsal room, but the way I prepare a show. I like to think about it quite deeply and get it very well organized before I move into the rehearsal room. Then I forget about that, and I look at what the actors are bringing me, and I try to work off what I see them presenting. But I like to have the set worked out, and I like, indeed, the structure, any structural problems in the text to be sorted out before you move into the essentially political context of rehearsing a play. And I think this is why we've got on so well. I mean, we begin, I read the play, and then we, over a number of weeks, we simply talk about it. And I try to find out what's in his head. And once I found out what's truly in his head, then I can concern myself with what's in my head in the way of vulgar theatrical flourishes and bits of business and coup de théâtre and surprises and things like that. But it's essential that I get really inside his mind. And I also ask very stupid and dumb questions, because I consider myself, Guthrie once described a director as the audience's representative. He's there to ensure that the audience is delivered of a really interesting show, so that everything is covered that they need to concern themselves with. And I ask those sort of questions on the behalf of audience members. Then I get him to read the play to me, which he hates doing, but he thinks he's a bad actor. He's not a bad, he's getting better. And again, if he reads the play, I can think about it while he's reading it. There's a line in Copenhagen about you can think about doing something and you can do it, but you can't do both at once. You're either doing it or you're thinking about it. And in this method of work, I do the thinking, he does the reading, and points come up for discussion. And that's how we work. Then he doesn't come to rehearsal. He's at liberty to come to rehearsal anytime he likes. But I think it's better for us to work and produce something, and when we've got something to show, to say, Michael, come along and see it. And he sees it, and he sees it absolutely fresh. And it's lovely to watch him, because authors are notorious at laughing at their own jokes. And one of the greatest pleasures I have, particularly in a comedy, is the first time Michael sees what we've done, and to see him laughing his head off beside me. And then I take his notes, and then he's with us really through the rest of the process.
I was going to sort of follow up on your mention of Chekhov just now, because you've done some of the major productions of Chekhov over the last 30 years, The Cherry Orchard at the National Theatre and Uncle Vanya, and most recently Three Sisters. And you've also made a film version of Uncle Vanya set in Australia, Country Life, which I think works extremely well personally. And I wondered if you'd ever had regrets that you didn't become the film director you wanted to be as a young man, and that whether you had inklings or sort of desires to do more work in film.
Well, I love film. The film, of course, is the director's medium, because there are so many more essential decisions that the film director has to make. But the trouble with film is that it takes ages to set anything up. I mean, in the days of the old Hollywood studios, you were assigned films. In the course of a year, you might do three or four or five or six. These days, to set up a film that's an interesting film, not a potboiler, you usually have to work for 3 years to get it financed. Then you seem to get it cast, you've got it ready to go, and 2 weeks before you shoot, the rug is pulled out from under your feet and the finance has disappeared. And I know so many people who've spent most of their lives not doing what they want to do, which is direct, but involving themselves in all the terrible business of raising money. So in that respect, I'm delighted I didn't become a film director, because, you know, when somebody asks me to do a play, it always happens. And in the course of a year, I can do what I'm meant to be doing, which is directing plays. But it is a terrific medium, and I do regret that possibly if I'd started earlier, I now would have a sort of body of film work, which I don't have. Yeah.
At this point, perhaps I'll open up to the audience and see if there are questions that people would like to ask Michael.
Well, I wasn't. I was in Australia when they made a film of Copenhagen, which I haven't seen, and it was just shown on Channel 4. And I gather, although the people are involved are very talented, that it doesn't really work particularly well because Copenhagen is such a stage event. I've seen clips from it, and it's brilliantly done, but the words get in the way and the pictures distract from the words. And when we did it on stage, it was so plain. We told the audience in advance, look, all we can offer you is good acting and text, so sit up and pay attention. And indeed they did. What Michael has done, I don't think his plays would make particularly good films, but his plays have benefited enormously from film culture. In other words, he never writes a scene longer, a word longer than it needs to. And in this latest play, Democracy, it's like a film to the extent that there's a series of quick scenes, and there are things like quick cuts into the middle of a scene without the scene beginning. You take the scene up where the meat is, and you leave it as soon as the meat is over. And that is borrowed from film. And the audience, of course, can follow that because they're used to film. But I don't think that certainly Democracy as written would make a good film of Brandt and the spy Guillaume. But I think the play has too many philosophical digressions and is too rooted in language, really, to film well.
I'm very struck by the extra you read, and about Olivier's style, and it comes across being a very refined style. I'm wondering, just from your point of view, as a field actor with him, did you find his performance tended to develop much through touring, or would it be pretty much the same from the end of the rehearsal process?
No, he knew exactly what he was doing by the first performance. It was really structured, really built. I think it's actually the difference between film acting and stage acting. I think in stage acting is a bit like Zen archery. Each night it's like taking the arrow from the quiver, putting it in the bow, shooting at the target, and doing the same thing, but each night trying to do it with a greater degree of perfection and exactitude. I think in film acting, it's quite the reverse. I think once that camera's running, somehow the actor has to live for a couple of minutes with freedom in front of the camera. And if he does a scene one way, if there are three takes, it'll soon get too constrained and too shaped, and then he'll need to go somewhere else and do something quite different. But I think stage acting is about making a shape, deciding what the performance is. I know when I directed him in Long Day's Journey Into Night, the part, James Tyrone, has this absolutely amazing fourth act with long, long speeches in which he describes the way he in his youth he was going to be an actor of enormous promise, and he kind of sold out when he got the chance to the rights of the Monte Cristo, and did that for the rest of his life, simply making money, and gave up his hopes of being taken as a serious actor. And at one of the rehearsals, Olivier had his book, and he did this scene, which consists mainly of long, long speeches by this man. And it was amazing to see, because it was a reading of such intelligence and invention and imagination, but he was doing it hushed, but it was all there, absolutely all there. It didn't leave me anything to say, really. I was just... and he was very proud of this. He was very proud of the fact he was a self-directing actor. I could direct him in scenes with the four other actors, but when he had a duologue, then I, for the most part, I left him alone because he knew what he was doing, and what he was doing was terribly exciting. And I remember saying to him when he was reading it from the book and putting in all his little bits of business and every little bit, every inflection was so shaped and perfected. I remember saying to him, look, if we ever get to do a television of this, this is the way you must play it. Right, take all the energy out of it, take all the stage energy out of it, and just play it from inside your head. But alas, somebody else directed the television version, and he gave his stage performance, and it was too big for the screen, and is still too big for the screen. It doesn't convey what happened in the theatre at all. I think it's in the nature, I'm afraid, it's in the nature of theatrical endeavour that it passes and fashions change. And it may be that if you saw an Olivier performance today, it wouldn't mean as much to you as it did in 1955. But I think there were contemporaries of Olivier's who were just as good actors. I mean, I think that Gielgud was as good an actor, Richardson in his own way was as good an actor, and there were other less well-known names who were quite as good as actors. But what Olivier was in a live performance, he was the greatest performer I have ever seen. He had the capacity to absolutely make the jaws of the entire house drop. I was in that Coriolanus you mentioned, and he had a bit of business in that. Well, not a business, bigger than business. But when he's killed, he's on an upper level. Orpheus is down below. And he's stabbed to death by Orpheus's followers. And having delivered this great speech about this boy, I, like an eagle in a dovecot, fluttered your Volsces in Corioli, he said. And he leapt forward in the air. There were five guys playing the Goths who, as he leapt into midair, he turned like that, and they had to catch him by the ankles like that so that he fell down and swayed backwards and forwards, dead. having been killed. He wanted a death like Mussolini's, upside down, riddled with bullets. And this was an extraordinarily audacious thing for a 51-year-old man to do. And you could hear, I used to stand in the wings with Vanessa Redgrave, and we used to lay bets that this would be the night that the most important actor in the Western world was dropped on his head. And it was amazing, because you would hear an entire house go, like that, as he went. And he loved doing these things. He loved these amazing physical moments that nobody dares do these days. I mean, they had the risk of... And in this case, it was an absolutely justified moment, because Coriolanus is a play in which the last scene is a long... this long scene between Volumnia, his mother, in which she persuades Coriolanus not to sack Rome. And then he dies in a rather peremptory way when his allies turn upon him. And it's always a very unsatisfactory ending. Most Shakespearean plays end with a battle or a duel. So there's something to release the tension of the previous drama in physical action. Coriolanus, which I think is a very, very great play, although Olivier once, we were watching it together at the Vic, and I said, Anthony Hopkins was playing it, and I said, what a great play. He said, no, not a great play, it's a great text. There's a difference. And it is a great, great text, but he made it a great play by giving it the one thing it needed to work as a dramatic entertainment. It needed that amazing moment, which he gave it. And he also developed, which again actors don't bother to do anymore because they don't need to. And people are, they can be mic'd, or most people's idea of acting derives from movie acting. But this extraordinary voice, which could crack a tray of glass tumblers. I mean, when he went into his upper registers, it was the whole fabric of the building shook. Well. We don't do that anymore. Maybe we don't need to. Was in my dressing room. Right. Well, the choreographer has a great latitude and has... we had a very brilliant choreographer, Kathleen Marshall, and she has considerable authority in her own right. I mean, I can certainly advise on her routines, but I would never arbitrarily interfere in what she's doing. Some of the routines were in the area of musical staging, which isn't quite dance. And in that area, the director and the choreographer usually work together. The opening number, you remember, did you see the production? Well, remember we transposed another opening, another show to the front of the evening. And that was so that the overture really became a staged version of the company moving into the theatre and the entrance of various leading characters, and it introduced the audience to the people in the play. And that went on for quite some time, and we both worked quite closely on that. But in a great number like Tom, Dick and Harry, which she choreographed brilliantly, I simply sat back and admired it. But in a musical, the director is kind of the general overseeing operations with a number of other generals, looking after their parts of the action. But it's a very thrilling thing to do, to direct a musical. I adore it.
Our time is almost up. I'm going to ask Michael two very quick questions before we finish. One is, I thought this was a beautifully, elegantly written memoir. Are you going to bring us up to date with what happened after Day and the Death of Joe Ake in a new memoir or a second volume?
Well, that took about 15 years, writing very intermittently, and I'm not quite sure that I've got 15 years available, but I might have.
And what are you doing next in the theatre?
Well, I'm going to do a production of Democracy in Australia, going back to Australia to do that, and then I'm working on bringing a musical to London. But it's a musical I did in New York a couple of years ago, written with a music by Cy Coleman called The Life. And it's something I was very committed to. And we did quite well. We ran for about a year. But it's on a very difficult subject, which is kind of low life in New York in the 1970s. And we needed help, and we were nominated for a great many Tonys, but the Tony went to Titanic, and we really needed it to get the general audience in. So, alas, the composer, who was a very great friend of mine, very brilliant man, Cy Coleman, died the other day, and I would like to get it on because I think it's his masterpiece, and I think it might go rather well in England. Something somewhat of a critique of American society, and I think that possibly the time is ripe.
Can I say thank you very much for coming to talk to us tonight, and can I urge everybody here, if they don't already possess a copy of this book, to get a copy and read it. It really is well worth reading, and as I say, it's a beautifully written memoir and also a sort of personal journey as well, which makes, I think, for quite profound reading at certain times in the tale that is told. So thank you very much for coming and talking to us tonight.
Thank you.